It was Albert Camus, the atheist novelist, who once wrote, "Without work, all life is rotten." He could have been listening in to last week's talk, if he hadn't been long dead. It's as if he'd sensed the truth we spotted then, that we were made for work. Our worth as a human being, it rightly involves work, and don't confuse that with just paid employment. Our identity as human beings involves work. Work is massively significant. However, any of you who know Camus well may well be suspecting already that the quote is almost too positive for him. The full quote goes like this: "Without work, all life is rotten, but when work is soulless, life stifles and dies." And that's the tension we need to face today. Work may be significant, but to put it crudely, it sucks. One of the reassuring things for me about the Bible, the Gospel, is not just that it tells me about God, though I wouldn't know him well without it. Now, one of the reassuring things for me is that the Gospel keeps explaining me. In fact, I trust its messages about what I don't know and can't see about God and a spiritual dimension to life and eternity, precisely because it is so accurate about what I do know, what I can see and touch, and especially accurate about me. Last week, we opened the first pages of the Bible and discovered why work is significant for us. We were made for work. It's in our DNA. It's how we were built and put together. This week, we're going to turn over one more page and discover the other truth, why work sucks. So let me start there as we come back to Genesis chapter 3 and the beginning of that chapter, why work sucks. The origins. There's not time for all the detail, and my focus today is less on the rebellion, more on the fallout from it. But then, of course, sometimes you don't notice the significance of an event, do you, until you see its consequences. I mean, on the very few times that I play chess, if you're fortunate enough to play against me, I will discover about 5 moves later why that knight you so innocently positioned is actually the cause of my entire downfall. I had a friend who was in the army, and he was telling me once how he'd borrowed an army motorbike just to go on a quick trip, and had a minor accident, just a little crash, some trivial damage. The next day he was in front of the commanding officer being torn off a strip or two, and at the end the CO said to him, "I'm not going to court-martial you this time." My friend said to me, "Until I heard those words, I never dreamed of the fact that I was in so much trouble." For him it was just a trivial scrape. Now, of course, in the popular mindset, what we have here in Genesis 3 is something like disobeying the keep off the grass sign, isn't it? You know, Adam and Eve munching an apple they shouldn't have done, like naughty school children. And then you look at the text. And the more you look, the more obvious it is. Actually, what we've got here is open defiance, a takeover bid, a rebellion to break God's monopoly. I mean, the language may all begin with talk about fruit and what you are and are not allowed to eat, but look at the subtext. Look at verse 4, for example. Look at the temptation there. No, I mean verse 5, actually. God knows when you eat of it, you will be like God. That's the heart of what's going on. That's the bait, the lure, the attraction. Freedom. Freedom to be the master of our own destinies. Freedom to decide for myself what's right and wrong, what's good and evil. And don't worry about the threats. Now, that's what verse 4 tells us. You won't surely die. They're just a bluff. Well, the fallout, of course, turns out to be massive. The whole gamut of relationships is left skewed and distorted. And the assessment of the world of the Garden of Eden shifts from it's very good to something far more devastating. Relationships with God are broken, of course. And you notice when you come to verse 8, did you, that it's not God hiding from us. You know, us hiding from him. Then the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they hid from the Lord God among the trees of the garden. And it isn't us searching for an elusive God. That's the way we love to think it always is. No, it's the other way around. Verse 9, but the Lord God called to the man, where are you? Of course, it doesn't stop with that one relationship. Relationships with the animal kingdom are fractured. You remember back in chapter 2, I mean, just look across to the previous column, really, verse 19. Now the Lord God had formed out of the ground all the beasts of the field and all the birds of the air, and he brought them to the man to see what he would name them, and whatever the man called them, that was its name. You know, and Adam did the job from A to Z, the aardvark to the zebra, they'd all got the name, and everything was fine. That picture of harmony is shattered now. So we come to our chapter 3, and we see the language God uses to the snake, the serpent, in verse 15, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. Of course, it's more than snakes and animals where fear and enmity creep in, for the serpent represents a spiritual force of evil, now set loose in the world, and that is now our enemy. And relationships with one another are distorted. You turn over the page to verse 16, and as God speaks judgment to Eve, here's what happens to relationships. Look at the end of verse 16. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Now, those words for desire and rule, they can both be thoroughly positive words or thoroughly negative. They use both ways in the Bible. But it seems in the context here and the flow of what goes on, you know, this is negative on both sides. Both sides scrabbling for a dominance or an exercising of a rule that's thoroughly unhealthy to relationship. And relationships with nature itself are skewed as well. Look what God says to Adam, verse 17, because you listened to your wife and you ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Notice, it is the ground that's cursed. Not Adam. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food, until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. You see, as God speaks, he says, Adam, the ground will rebel against your rule, just as you rebelled against God's rule. And in an agrarian economy, that drastically changes the world of work. It's not that there was no labor before. We saw that last week. You remember, Adam's put in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. Just that it's a lot harder now. Frustration and sweat are built in as they never had been before. Well, that same far-reaching rebellion we see here in Adam and Eve, it's part of each of our genetic makeup. It's handed on from one generation to another. Theologians will speak of original sin, but actually any parent has only got to watch their baby grow up, and they'll see it there, a natural, instinctive, selfish, self-centered life amidst all the charm of the baby's gurgles and smiles is there. Why is it that parents are always having to say no? Why is it even the most sort of weak and miserable of parents, we're always trying to teach our children the right things. I've never known parents sit them all round the breakfast table and say, now, how do we mess it up today? Let's have the lesson and see if we can. No, you don't have to do that. And the extensiveness of the consequences are built into our lives too. Earlier this summer, my daughter had a brain virus. Her younger brother responded to the news much like younger brothers love to. He just laughed at the idea that there was a brain in which to have a virus. But when she had the scans later, she asked for a copy of the picture so that she could prove to him there really was one there. For a while, they weren't sure if she had a tumour. But when all the scans were taken, they assured her there were no tumours. It was just a virus. It would go and disappear. And then they added, what's more, there was no scarring, which never occurred to me, this, but it can often occur when a virus is there and could cause permanent damage. So for her, no permanent damage, but Adam and Eve's defiance did leave scarring. Permanent damage. And ours does the same. Oh, you can still see the made in the image of God mark on every human being. But the scarring is there too. Theologians will speak of total depravity, by which they don't mean you are the worst you could possibly be. Oh, no, not that. Just that the scarring spreads everywhere. That's the sense in which it's total. You know, it's like you put one red sock in the wash. You know, everything is pink at the end. Not as pink as it could possibly be, but pink enough. Well, it's like that. Our rebellion means God has left us with a world that doesn't respond, it's very good, but mercifully declares instead, something's wrong. Something's wrong. It's there all around us, and it includes the world of work. And you know, I'll never understand why work is as it is without looking through the lens of Genesis 3. Why work sucks, the origins. Secondly, why work sucks, the practice. Because, of course, the workplace has changed and developed in many parts of the world since those early days, and the modern workplace would be unimaginable to Adam and Eve. At least we like to think that, don't we? But it actually developed pretty fast then. You see, just look across the page to chapter 4 and verse 17. And you discover Cain is building a city. The creativity of the architect and the builder is there for him. Or go to verse 20. And you'll come across Jabal, the cattle rancher. Or verse 21, where you'll come across the father of musicians. Or verse 22, the father of manufacturers and toolmakers. And as you read through the pages of the Old Testament, you'll discover it has among its heroes all kinds of workers, from civil servants to household servants, from midwives to politicians. And by the way, often involved in setups where our recent expenses scandals would seem small beer. And everywhere, the scarring is evident, sometimes brutally so. See, earlier on in chapter 4, in verse 8, Cain says to his brother Abel, let's go out into the field. That is Abel's workplace. And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. The first workplace death. And a very brutal one. But the scarring, of course, doesn't just come out in violent ways. We break the connection with God. Well, don't be surprised if we struggle to trace back the thread between our jobs and the work He designed for us. What's good and fulfilling loses its purpose. It's drowned in a sea of targets and efficiency drives and profit indicators. But they blind us to ways in which our work can be part of caring for God's world. So there are people who are doing jobs that serve others, but it is drowned in the relentless grind of the conveyor belt. And sparks of creativity can get snuffed out in the need to deliver. And what's good and fulfilling sometimes slips into idolatry, doesn't it? Some of us replace God with our work. We saw last week that what can you do can be an affirming question and a fair question and part of my identity question, but it was never intended to be the whole of my identity or even my prime identity. We've introduced an idolatry into our work, and it can define us and even consume us. A career on some people's lips becomes not just a word that speaks of commitment to excellence and doing my best, but a badge of self-importance. He's got a job on the checkout at Tesco's, but she's making a career for herself in accountancy. Lord Griffiths, who was Brian Griffiths, was the former economics advisor to Margaret Thatcher. He's now the vice chairman of Goldman Sachs. I heard a lecture he gave a few months back in which he likened the culture of some banks and their working hours to a kind of voluntary slavery. All absorbing. Here's a very different kind of work. And a very shrewd observation. Tiger Woods, the golfer, he said this, life is never all about golf. Golf is what I do. I don't want to be defined as a golfer. I want to be defined by my character as a person. He doesn't want his work to be his God. And we break the connection with God and we struggle to find its true purpose. We break the connection with one another, and it shows inevitably in the workplace, from exploitation to jealousy and cattiness, from laziness to trampling over others in the rush for promotion, from greed, dominated so many recent headlines, hasn't it, to theft. I think of my friend who was an electrician. He rewired a mate's house with bits taken from work. And he said to me once in a conversation, he said, if I was to become one of your Christians, I'm never quite sure what one of my Christians is, but anyway, if I was to become one of your Christians, he said, I suppose that would have to stop, wouldn't it? He actually was quite perceptive about himself. Lord Griffiths might speak of voluntary slavery, but there's many a sweatshop where it's far from voluntary. See, work that was designed to be so significant and satisfying too easily becomes a tool for evil and exploitation. Harold Macmillan, the former Prime Minister, once said of the commandment about the Sabbath, you know, 6 days shall you do all the work you need to do. On the seventh day, you shall rest. He described that commandment as the greatest worker protection act in history. Well, here we are. Work is significant, and work sucks. We all live with limited job satisfaction. Actually, we all live with limited life satisfaction. For some, the chinks of purpose and satisfaction, that they're broader than they are for others. For some, the shadows seem almost overwhelming. But the origins of the limited satisfaction, they lie with our rebellion, and mercifully it's left us in a world that keeps shouting at us, something's wrong, something's wrong. We're made for so much, and we experience so much less. Surely life wasn't meant to be like this. And I turn to the gospel, and I understand myself and my hopes and my frustrations. And I catch myself asking, is that God's final word? Has God got anything more to say? And even in the midst of the depressing readings we've looked at today, you see the signs that he has. Just turn back to Genesis 3 and verse 15, will you? As he speaks to the serpent, he says, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and hers. That's going to be the battleground and the tension that plays itself out throughout human history. But he doesn't stop there, does he? He will crush your head. He, the seed of Eve, will crush your head. You will strike his heel. Which is why the Bible story, the gospel story, it's the search for the rescuer who's going to break the chains. We won't find him until we come to the cross of Christ. But that, as they say, is for next week. Thanks for listening.